Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Greetings, dear listeners. Daniel here. We have a special bonus episode for you. That's right. We're pumping out two episodes in a week. Claude and I wanted to do something special for Valentine's Day. So we recorded a special episode to celebrate the day and also help us exercise some of our poetics muscles that we worked on in the previous episode. So we're taking a look at the poetry of the 17th century English poet John Donne. His work is really suffused with a kind of earthy eroticism combined with a very divinely oriented kind of deeper soulful love that makes for a very heady mix and really makes for fascinating and beautiful poetry. I think you guys are really going to enjoy this episode. I certainly really enjoyed reading for it and talking about it with my buddy Claude. The Cannonball is proud to be a member of the Agora Podcast Network, and this month the Agora Podcast Network is featuring the French History Podcast. This is a terrific podcast tracing the history of France all the way back to its beginnings as a barbarian kingdom set up in the former Roman Gaul up to the present day, a full 1,500-year span from Clovis to Clemenceau. And interspersed there are all kinds of episodes, not just following kind of that linear track, but addressing topics in French culture and history from all over that range. So it's a really fascinating and very well done podcast. I just finished up listening to the series on the Merovingian dynasty and the Dark Ages of France, which was absolutely fascinating. And I learned a ton about a topic that I thought I had a pretty good handle on. So I think you guys will really enjoy it too. The French History Podcast from Agora Podcasts, available wherever fine podcasts like the one you are about to listen to are found. And without further ado, here is your Valentine's Day special.
Hello, happy Valentine's Day, and welcome to The Cannonball, a podcast attempt to read all the books in Harold Bloom's list of the Western canon. As I mentioned before, we're doing a special episode today to celebrate Valentine's Day with the poetry of John Donne. We had mentioned Donne in the previous episode on poetics. He came up and we were talking after the show. Donne's one of my favorites. I really love going back to his stuff. And we figured, okay, we'll probably be long dead by the time we make it even out of the 19th century. There's no way we'll be able to double back and do all of the cool, you know, stuff that's back there. And we thought this might be just a fun opportunity, you know, to play up the cheesy holiday, but also get a little bit into Donne just because, you know, we might not pass this way again. So this is our Valentine's Spectacular with the mostly erotic poetry of John Donne.
As I'm sure St. Valentine himself would have wanted.
Of course. Well, I owe my reading of Donne to a particular professor I had in grad school, and I'm really sort of indebted to this one professor. He taught us 17th century literature and 17th century poetry, and he influenced the way I read Donne. And he also had a really sort of fascinating take on Donne and a kind of project to go along with Donne. All right. His question was why anyone was reading Donne in the early 20th century at Harvard. All right.
Yeah.
So the reason that question matters is because of who in particular came out of Harvard in the early 20th century and was reading Donne, and that was T.S. Eliot.
Yeah.
Donne was really fairly ignored for, I guess, most of the 18th and into the 19th century, or at least his poetry was ignored. His biography was well known because it was sort of like an object lesson in, I guess, reforming your past bad behaviors. But the poetry was too complicated for the 18th century. Samuel Johnson famously denigrated it as metaphysical. So he's associated with a school called the Metaphysical Poets, but that was a designation that was meant to be derogatory. In the 19th century, the Victorians dug his biography because it was sort of the biography of the reformed rake. And then for some reason, T.S. Eliot latched onto his poetry and sort of used it to justify some of the moves that he was making in his poetry. So Eliot had this fascination for 17th century verse, and there's a kind of parallel fascination that you can see sort of in the Spanish modernists.
Yeah.
The generation of 26, I believe, was really sort of indebted to some of the golden age Spanish poetry that was deemed too complicated and weird and strange throughout the 18th and 19th century, but then sort of reemerges in the 20th century. Well, this professor I had was wondering why in the hell anybody was reading Donne at Harvard in the early 20th century. And he got very, very interested in the way Donne was taught, how he was taught, where he fit into a curriculum, if he fit in at all. And there's this whole, you know, longer story that you can get into that I'm not going to get into about this group at Harvard that was trying to, in some way, establish roots for an American literary canon. I think that's what it really comes down to, is that they were looking back through English literary history to try to find some kind of intervention that they could make on American writing.
Yeah.
And to look for some kind of foundation for American writing. And weirdly enough, they tended to use Milton as a kind of foundation for American writing. He fits certain kinds of revolutionary parameters that are maybe a little terrifying if you're English, and maybe a little enticing if you're a nation whose national mythos is to be born out of a revolution against a king. You follow.
Yeah.
So in any case, excuse me, Eliot revived Donne's reputation. And since the early 20th century and since Eliot's revival, there's been, you know, renewed interest in reading him, I suppose, among people who read poetry. But the reason Johnson denigrated his verse as metaphysical is because Donne will take a comparison. And, you know, in the 17th and 18th century, they would have called this a conceit. Mm-hmm. And just spin it to its furthest possible limit. Take a trope and then take it as far as he logically can. Sometimes in baffling ways, sometimes in really grotesque ways. But that's what I find really sort of fascinating about him, is that he will extend the logic of this thing as far as it can go. It's really sort of fun. Mm-hmm. So was this your first time reading through Donne?
It was my first time reading Donne in any sort of great amount. I remembered, I know I read The Flea in high school. I remember that pretty clearly about our English teacher having a lot of fun explaining what it was to some scandalized 16-year-olds. But I don't know that I've read much beyond that. And if I did, it would have been many, many years ago. So it's not, I mean, my experience with Dunn is pretty much limited to the last couple days when I was reading the selections that we made today. I was kind of aware of him as a sort of presence in the history of English letters and remembered him as being like that horny guy. But I hadn't really sort of spent any time with the poetry and like, I absolutely understand why he would be a favorite of yours. Like the language is, it's impeccable. It's really pretty astonishing. It's really weird to me anyway. Like it's a very like, I don't know, like it's simultaneously like I said, so metaphysical, but, earthy. I don't know if that's a euphemism for horny, but
well, the thing, whenever I teach Dunn, what I always sort of like to say is that he can't get his sex out of his theology and he can't get his theology out of his sex.
Absolutely. Yeah. Like, yeah.
And he strikes me as carrying on a kind of Catholic tradition.
Well, I was like I guess when we get to The Flea, I noticed something regarding that. We can discuss.
Oh, but, dear. Yes. Well, you know, there's – I mean, I was thinking more along the lines of someone like St. John of the Cross, mm-hmm. the sort of Spanish Catholic tradition of trying to articulate in a physical sense the divine love. Like what does this right. mean? And you know, in ways that are often disconcerting – when you're trying to frame that, you can get into some weird territory. Erotics of theology.
Yeah, I mean that's really the. Well, I mean that's kind of at the beating heart of Trinitarian Christianity, anyway, isn't it? Like the whole idea is that the love of God was instantiated in a flesh and blood body.
There you go.
And how, like, how, you know, it's a 2000 year intellectual tradition to asking, you know, beating your head against the wall saying how, and exploring how and trying to express what that would mean. And I mean, it's, you know, it's a wonderful, of course, clearly it's a wonderful impetus toward, you know, human intellectual expression and exploration. And,
All right. So we covered. If you're interested in the bio, I did as brief a thumbnail sketch as I could in the Poetics episode. I can cover that a little bit very, very quickly here just so that you have it. But the gist of it mostly tends to be that Dunn was born to a Catholic family in England in the 17th century. In the 16th century, but he lived through the 17th. As a Catholic family, they couldn't practice. And in fact, his brother was caught, I believe, taking mass at one point from a priest clandestinely and was sent to jail for it and died in prison. He was trained basically as a kind of lawyer theologian in university, but because he was a Catholic, he couldn't take a degree. He couldn't hold public office. He couldn't do all kinds of things, but he had to be very, very careful. And he was very, very careful. He was always attuned to what was blasphemous and what was not blasphemous, what was heretical and what was not heretical. And he sort of knew how to thread that needle. Excuse me. So he would take odd jobs and just kind of like cobble together a clerical livelihood. And according to tradition, the biography we have of him was written after his death by someone who I believe didn't know him very well. So it's one of those things where you have to kind of take it with a grain of salt. That was sort of like the famous biography that was passed on down the way. But for the most part, it seems to be that he wrote most of his poems fairly early, like when he was around 20. Don't hold me to that. But I think around late teens, early 20s. And they were sort of written to be passed around, performed. you know, things like that, like poetry in the 16th, 17th century, unless you were a grubby little playwright trying to publish for money, it yeah. was sort of a gentleman's pursuit or just something that you do to pass the time with your friends. You know, now you go to a party, you turn on your phone or you'd hook your phone up to a speaker and you'd, you know, pump whatever playlist that you've got handy. Well, in the 17th century, you know a dude who plays the guitar, so you compose a couple of songs for that, and then that guy writes it down, hands it to a friend, that guy writes it down, hands it to a friend, that guy writes it down, so it gets passed around. So it's it was in circulation in kind of like a literal way, circling from one person to another. All right, so then he gets married, has kids, quote-unquote reforms. And there are several poems, one of which we're going to read tonight, that are attributed to basically him writing to his wife, love poems to his wife. And then eventually his wife dies. He is convinced late in life to formally join the English church, and he becomes an Anglican minister and head of one of the bigger cathedrals in London. And he's a huge draw as a preacher. So even today, his sermons are really sort of fascinating rhetorical documents. Dies as this sort of revered figure in I guess, English life in the 17th century. So that's the thumbnail sketch. All right. Yeah. But what about the poetry? I wanted to start with this poem that's usually put at the beginning of his books. When you get a collected edition of Donne, or even, you know, say you open up the Norton anthology, the poem that's usually put at the front is The Good Morrow. So, Daniel, would you like to do the honors and read The Good Morrow?
Absolutely.
So all right, thank you.
I have it pulled up right here. Here we are. The Good Morrow. I wonder by my troth what thou and I did till we loved? Were we not weaned till then, but sucked on country pleasures childishly? Or snorted we in the seven sleepers' den? 'Twas so, but this all pleasures fancies be. If ever any beauty I did see, which I desired and got, 'twas but a dream of thee. And now good morrow to our waking souls, which watched not one another out of fear, for love, all love of other sights controls, and makes one little room and everywhere. Let sea discoverers to new worlds have gone. Let maps to others worlds on worlds have shown. Let us possess one world. Each hath one and is one. My face in thine eyes, thine in mine appears, and true plain hearts do in the faces rest. Where can we find two better hemispheres without sharp north, without declining west? Whatever dies was not mixed equally. If our two loves be one, or thou and I love so alike, that none do slacken, none can die.
Yeah, it's a really wonderful poem. It hinges on a couple of things. But I think what I always sort of admire about the first stanza is that tremendous risk he's taking. Like, this is the speaker, right? I wonder what did we do before we loved each other? That's a kind of scary conversation to have. you know, and to this speaker's credit, or to Donne's credit, he's sort of opening this up. It's not just me, it's you and me. What did we do? Right. Were we, you know, innocent out there? Snorted we in the seven sleepers' den? Were we not weaned till then, but sucked on country pleasures childishly? Were we sort of unaware of what we did? And country pleasures can be a euphemism for sexual activity. That comes up in Hamlet. So there's a suggestion there that maybe each of them was kind of off in their own sort of physical bliss childishly, thoughtlessly, you know, it's kind of naively or innocently. And check this out. But for this, i.e. this relationship that we have right now, all pleasures fancies be. But for this relationship, everything else was just a fantasy or a dream. If ever any beauty I did see, which I desired and got, Man, that's the kicker.
Yeah.
He's really treading that line. If ever any beauty I did see, which I desired and got, which was but a dream of thee. So all of my past activity was just the dream. And now good morrow to our waking souls.
And not just a dream, but a dream of thee. Like it's the, in this, you know, whatever kind of amorous adventures I got up to were merely prefiguring what we have.
Exactly.
And it's really, and you had like the, which I think is interesting sort of, you know, getting back to the Christianity sort of embedded in all of this, that is, well, for one, mentioning the seven sleepers, that's a fame. I believe there are seven martyrs from the Roman persecutions. It's the seven sleepers myth. But also just this idea of, you know, the true, you know, that everything being a prefigurement of the true reality that happens to me. I mean, that's how the Christian tradition reads, say, the Old Testament, you know, that they're always looking for, or even like the Greek myths. Like there was a big business in the Byzantine scholastic tradition, which was of course heavily, well, not scholastic, like the scholastics, school scholastics, but you know what I mean? An academic tradition, kind of devoted to, as part of kind of rescuing the classics, that Hellenic heritage that they were so proud of. Mm-hmm. Sort of making a case for why this or that myth is actually just a garbled sort of prefiguring, or a garbled flash of insight of the true Christian message. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of what really jumped out at me reading this one, that which I desired and got, 'twas but a dream of thee, that prefiguring, that talking about like everything prior to this was but a pale shadow of what this is.
Exactly. Yeah. That was the dream. This is the reality. And I love and now good morrow to our waking souls, which watch not one another out of fear, for love, all love of other sides controls. We're staring at each other, not because we're scared that one is going to leave. We're staring at each other out of true affection, which makes you desire to see the other person. And that desire becomes this kind of like mutually reinforced project here. Mm-hmm. Let sea discoverers to new worlds have gone. Let maps to others worlds on worlds have shown. Let us possess one world. Each hath one and is one. We have one world. Each hath one and is one. And this is where we're getting into some funky territory. So I want to bring up one critic first, and when we get into the second or into the third stanza, I can bring up another. William Empson wrote this really interesting essay. William Empson was I guess early to mid 20th century poet, scholar, and critic. He wrote a book, Seven Types of Ambiguity and Some Versions of Pastoral, and How to Do Things. Is it How to Do Things with Complex Words or How to Do Things with Words? I can't recall. But no. He's a very vivacious writer. He can do things with words that are just fascinating and astounding, and he has an attunement to language itself that he's often accused of being a formalist critic. He wasn't. Okay, he was a formalist critic, but not in that kind of deadening new critical way that you think. He's actually very, very vibrant and alive and attuned to all the complexities and ambiguities of language itself. And he can do some things with words and question things about words that sort of prefigure some of the later, I guess, not quite deconstruction, but the other later kinds of laser focused fascination with how language operates. He did this essay on Dunn called Dunn the Spaceman, where he examines, you know, if you're interested in Dunn and interested in just weird literary criticism, he has this take on Dunn where he seems to suggest that Dunn in some of his writings is thinking just beyond the earth. Mm-hmm. Like if the earth is one world, then perhaps there are other worlds that are also inhabited. And if God created those other worlds that are like this world, and God is the master of all creation, God created all creation, then do those other worlds have their own individual Christs? There's this way that Dunn is trying to stretch his imagination or stretch how he's thinking about how the world functions. But here, there's this idea of two becoming one. Each hath one world and is one world. Two individual people inhabit a world and then can become their own world through physically joining. And I think that's where we get into the third paragraph. That's or the third stanza. That's what the third stanza is really all about.
Yeah.
He's being erotic without being explicit. My face in thine eyes, thine in mine appears. I mean, how close do you have to be to a person to have your face appear reflected in that person's eye? And one and true plain hearts do in the faces meet, or do in the faces rest. Where can we find two better hemispheres without sharp north, without declining west? How can they become the globe without sharp north and without declining west when they are too fused together?
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Whatever dies was not mixed equally. Now, usually your Norton Anthology footnote is going to say that what he's referring to is this idea in early alchemy or early sort of humors theory that health depends on all the bodily fluids being equally mixed, so that if everything is in perfect equilibrium, then you will live forever.
Yeah.
You follow?
Yeah, yeah. That any kind of deleterious bodily effect was due to not having enough of some substance or having too much of another, etc.
So if they're in perfect harmony together, then they will keep being for eternity because this is perfect harmony.
Yeah.
However, there's another pun. Daniel? What might the word die suggest to a reader or an audience living in the 17th century? How is that a pun?
Does this have anything to do with Le Petit Mort? As
you
we
got it.
The little death. Okay. All right. See, okay. I know about this stuff.
All right. If none do slacken, if we stay in perfect harmony in this rhythm right here together, then we never have to stop.
Yeah.
So it's eternal equilibrium represented in sexual union, which will just keep going bliss to bliss to bliss to bliss to bliss with no ultimate conclusion.
I believe that the technical term is edging in the sexual arts community.
Well, you know, that came up back when we were doing Faust.
That's right. Yeah.
That's really sort of the weird thing that seems to be the bonus here, to keep at play, to keep going with no ultimate end or no ultimate goal. And that gets me to the other essay that I wanted to bring up. I should have looked it up. I'm doing this without notes. There's an essay by Christopher Ricks. Ricks is another one that you really should look up, or anyone who's interested in words should look up. He wasn't exactly a student of Ibsen, but he gained a lot by reading lots of Ibsen. Let's put it that way. But he's still alive. He did the complete Variorum edition of T.S. Eliot's poetry that came out, I guess, a few years ago. It's these two giant bricks. He's a scholar and a literary editor, and he was also one of my professors in undergrad. And, yeah. You know, anytime I read his stuff, I can hear his voice. But he's another extraordinarily sprightly writer who is just radically attuned to language and words, and can pick words apart like you wouldn't believe. He's also a huge fan of Bob Dylan's, and a kind of gateway into his writing and thinking is his book on Dylan. He did a really fascinating book on Dylan's lyrics, and he sort of takes them apart and ticks them, talks them, and turns them all about. So if you're looking for a literary critic that can sort of get you entry into language, another one to look at is Christopher Ricks. Ricks did an essay on Donne where he says in the second or third sentence that his essential thesis is that Donne was a poet who was afraid to come. And he breaks that down. He says, you know, this may sound grotesque or absurd, but when you think about what that would have meant in the 17th century in England, it makes a lot of sense. It's not about any kind of superstitious belief that, you know, you are weakened by every ejaculation. It has to do with the pragmatics of getting your wife pregnant for the seventh or eighth or ninth time and, you know, having her possibly die in childbirth. There are all kinds of complications that we in the 21st century don't really have to deal with. And so he took a look at a lot of Donne's writing, where Donne sort of resists sexual culmination or sexual conclusion, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And it's really sort of a fascinating read. Now, what Donne is doing with it in this poem is grasping onto a kind of metaphysics, I think. Or like, seriously, like a theological, spiritual metaphysics.
Yeah.
But it's a part of a lot of his poetry. So he's, if you're looking for an edgelord, I suppose it's time.
Oh, boy.
All right. So shall we go on to the flea?
Let's do. Let's see. Let me find that where I have in my volume here.
And I will look for it as well. So this is one that you read in high school?
This is one that I read in high school. And I guess it must have been like a unit, or I want to say it was like 11th grade. And we were covering Shakespeare also. So it was kind of the big rough collar era of English literature. But this was included in, I believe it was in a Norton anthologized, you know, those Norton school textbooks. But here we are.
Okay. So would you do us the honor and read it, please?
I shall do so. Here we are. Mark, but this flea, and mark in this, how little that which thou deniest me is. Me it sucked first, and now sucks thee, and in this flea our two bloods mingled be.
Confess it, this cannot be said a sin or shame or loss of maidenhead. Yet this enjoys before it woo, and pampered swells with one blood made of two. And this, alas, is more than we would do. Oh, stay, three lives and one flea spare, where we almost, nay, more than married are. This flea is you and I, and this our marriage bed and marriage temple is. Though parents grudge, and you, we're met, and cloistered in these living walls of jet. Though use make you apt to kill me, let not to this self-murder added be, and sacrilege, three sins in killing three. Cruel and sudden hast thou since purpled thy nail in blood of innocence. In what could this flea guilty be, except in that drop which it sucked from thee? Yet thou triumph'st and sayest that thou findest not thyself, nor me the weaker now. 'Tis true, then learn how false fears be. Just so much honor, when thou yieldest to me, will waste as this flea's death took life from thee.
All right. I love it. It's an argument.
It's basically done as the sex lawyer. Here.
Yeah, he's spitting game, as one of my students put it about 10 years ago.
That's terrific. He is. He absolutely is.
That's really what it comes down to. And I like the way that you put it. He's the sex lawyer. There's a case that he's trying to make. And this is a really fun performative poem. And, you know, this is one that I always ask my students about. How do you feel about it? Is this over the line? Is he going into creep territory? Most of them, you know, I open it up. I take sexual harassment very seriously. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I ask them, wait, how do you guys feel about this? And for the most part, I think they go along with the tone. There's something in the tone that seems more playful than threatening, if that makes sense. And
yeah,
that's
yeah.
how I tend to find it. Though I am totally aware that a listener or a reader might really be turned off by this. And I kind of have to throw that out there. But
I think what kind of saves it is the fact that it's clear that the two of them are already sharing a bed, which kind of indicates that things are pretty advanced, you know, that it's not simply this, he's not just accosting someone.
Right.
Like there's already a closeness at work and it's being playful.
Yeah. And I think that playfulness, Dunn is not without his misogyny, and I'll show you an example of that later, but there is a kind of playfulness to this that I think sort of saves it from utter creephood. It is a sort of legalistic rhetorical argument. Take a look at this flea. It sucked blood from me. It sucks blood from you. And our fluids are all sort of mingled up in there together.
Mm-hmm.
That's about what we would do. And there's nothing, you know, harmful or unnatural about that. So
not only that's about what we would do, it goes further than what we would do.
Exactly. So have sex with me.
Right. So, I mean, it's a done deal. But I mentioned the Christian themes that leaped out at me in this. I mean, I can't help but see the, what is it here? Three lives in one flea.
Oh yeah, right? The Trinity.
It's Trinitarian. It's Trinitarian. Like the three persons are in, just all encompassed in the one term flea, and so this it's a very God. It's funny. It's this, you know, invoking the Trinity, invoking the Trinity in a vermin.
Yeah,
you know, a tiny insect, a pest.
In order
to talk your lady into, you know, getting down with you. I mean, you've done it again.
Well, that was – all right. This professor I had in grad school, that was sort of his case, that Dunn is blasphemous, that he literally blasphemes. But in order to blaspheme this completely, you need to take the religion seriously, right? Like,
yeah.
Okay. I guess the way to put it, I can't remember the scholar's name. There's a philosopher at Princeton who did a book called On Bullshit. And his thesis.
Oh, yeah. I remember we actually carried that at the library when it came out.
It's a fast. Shit. I should have looked it up. I can't remember the scholar's name. But it's a slim little treatise, but he's a scholar who's interested in truth claims. and how you make truth claims and how you verify and things like that. But he tried to articulate that there's this position. All right. In order to tell the truth, you need to know what the truth is. Mm-hmm. And in order to lie, you need to know what the truth is, because you can't say the thing that is not unless you know the thing that is, because you're purposefully saying what is not. But then he says that there's this other sort of category of statement that he calls bullshit that disregards truth altogether. It's sort of motivated statement or statement motivated by something other than truth that doesn't know what truth is and doesn't care what truth is. So think about, you know, Fox News commentary or, you know, any kind of, I guess, internet flame war where you're being politically manipulated into, you know, sort of ridiculous sides. Someone has an agenda and they really don't care what the truth is. All right. Alex Jones, right? He's trying to sell pills, or he's trying to sell what have you. And he just goes on air and rants and rambles until, you know, he gets to the point to terrify the audience to get them to buy something. Or Rush Limbaugh is the same way, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
They don't have a regard for truth. Truth is not what they do. It's not part of their wheelhouse. They have some other kind of agenda. All right. The reason I'm talking about that is to get back to what this professor had sort of articulated about Dunn. He is going out of his way to blaspheme, but in order to do so, it must mean that he knows the religion backwards and forwards. Right. He knows the theology backwards and forwards, and he takes it seriously enough to transgress in this manner. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
So it's perfectly within his wheelhouse to use the Trinity established in a vermin in order to get his lady to have sex with them. there's something, you know, over the, this is what I mean when I say that Dunn is over the top and weird and can take it to its furthest level and can get really bizarre and grotesque with it. But that's sort of why it's fun, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, the other side of it is, this isn't the only flea poem that was written in the Elizabethan Jacobean era. The flea poem was a genre. Huh. And Dunn got his hands on it and said, "Now let me show you how it's done." And really took it to where you can take it. And I love the conclusion of this poem. The conclusion is that there is no conclusion. Okay. There's a kind of action between each stanza. That's what I sort of love when I say it's performative. Between the first and second stanza, she goes to, you know, pick it up and maybe kill it. And he tells her not to kill it. And then between the second and third stanza, she does. She pops a flea. And cruel and sudden, hast thou since purple thy nail in blood of innocence. She has killed the thing. And his earlier claim was, this represents the Trinity and has a piece of you and a piece of me in it. So when you kill it, you're going to be killing parts of us. Well, now I don't see that I'm any weaker. So that just shows you how you shouldn't succumb to all kinds of ridiculous anxieties. So you should sleep with me. It's an argument that doesn't end. He can keep twisting it and keep tweaking it and keep tweaking it. And there's this playfulness to it. It's sort of like, whatever objection, how's he going to overcome it? Or try to overcome it? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah.
sort of the lack of the ending that I find fascinating. But let's move from, I guess, some of his raunchier, weirder, more grotesque stuff to a really, 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 really sweet one, The Valediction Forbidding Mourning.
Okay.
All right. Would you do me a favor and read that one?
I shall.
Had you read this one before?
No, this was totally new to me.
Okay.
And you're right, it's beautiful. And so, I feel honored and blessed to read it to our listeners.
Well, to make it even sweeter, this is apocryphal, but usually this is one that the story goes, Dunn was an attaché, more or less. He was sort of like a personal secretary to an ambassador. This is for real. We know this. And he had to go to the continent often for months at a time. So the apocryphal sort of legend about this poem is that he wrote it for his wife before leaving for one of these journeys. No idea if that's true or not, but it's a sweet story. And this is our Valentine's episode, so why not?
Here we go.
Okay.
As virtuous men pass mildly away and whisper to their souls to go, while some of their sad friends do say, the breath goes now, and some say, no. So let us melt and make no noise, no tear floods nor sigh tempests move, toward profanation of our joys to tell the laity of our love. Moving of the earth brings harms and fears. Men reckon what it did and meant, but trepidation of the spheres, though greater far, is innocent. Dull sublunary lovers love, whose soul is sense, cannot admit absence, because it doth remove those things which elemented it. But we, by a love so much refined, that ourselves know not what it is, enter assured of the mind, care less eyes, lips, and hands to miss. Our two souls, therefore, which are one, though I must go, endure not yet a breach, but an expansion, like gold to airy thinness beat. If they be two, they are two so as stiff twin compasses are two. Thy soul, the fixed foot, makes no show to move, but doth if the other do. And though it in the center sit, yet when the other far doth roam, it leans and hearkens to it, and grows erect as that comes home. Such wilt thou be to me, who must, like the other foot, obliquely run. Thy firmness makes my circle just, and makes me end where I begun.
Thank you so much. You're a really wonderful reader of these.
Well, thank you.
All right.
So, I'm actually that is reassuring to me, Claude, because you know my problems I have with meter and line breaks and sentences. So I'm glad to know I'm not butchering this totally.
No. That's wonderful. That was wonderful. Thank you so much. So the beginning of the poem, you know, the first stanza is making this comparison to the dying, right? Mm-hmm. At someone's deathbed, you know, if it's a virtuous person, then they should be able to let go, right? And mm-hmm. some of the friends will, you know, friends, family, you'll be upset, you'll be sad, you'll be, mourning. And he makes a comparison to himself and whoever the beloved is here, right? Mm-hmm. Let's be like that. Let's not show our grief at having to separate, because that would profane our love, right? He keeps wanting to go to this idea that whatever they have is something spiritual and deep and above and beyond, you know, metaphysical.
Yeah. Well, metaphysical and almost, I don't know, alchemical. There's a rather hermetic kind of cadence to all this. I don't know how explicit that is, or whether I'm, you know, barking up the wrong tree, but,
Well, to a degree, I'm not sure how interested Donne was in alchemy, but it was definitely, I mean, he's already been talking about the humors. I mean, it's of the time.
We got humors. We're talking about spheres. We're talking about the sublunary. I don't know. It feels, hermetic.
Well, so sublunary lovers, that would be, you know, lovers under the moon, i.e. physical lovers, right?
Yeah.
He seems to have in mind some kind of picture of space, something close to Dante. You know, dull sublunary lovers love whose soul is sense cannot admit absence, because it doth remove those things which elemented it. So if you're just in it for the booty, then when the booty's gone,
then it's gone.
It's gone, right?
Yeah.
But we who have this other kind of spiritual, metaphysical connection with each other, we don't feel that loss. But we buy a love
so
much
for it's not that we're sundered, but rather our love now expands as far as each of us might roam from the other.
So the first comparison is to gold, to airy thinness beat. You know, you can take gold and beat it out to, you know, paper thin, and you can make decadent dessert toppings with that paper thin.
That's right.
Excuse me. But that's the first comparison.
Or you can also make Goldschlager with it, which I am sadly more familiar with.
Oh, dear. That was a bad night.
Absolutely. Anyway.
Thankfully, it was only one. Yeah. All right. So anyway, but yeah, so to refine the love and to have it, you know, transmuted into gold, I guess this is the alchemy there, but gold to airy thinness be, you know, stretched out as far as it possibly can. Their souls are one thing. So even though their bodies are two, their souls are one thing. Stretched out to the furthest possible limit. And then he changes his mind about that comparison and uses this other comparison, stiff twin compasses, right? And what he's talking about there, maybe they don't do this anymore. I'm not quite sure. I'm sure there's a safety concern, but I remember in high school in geometry class, you had to get a compass where you have, you know, it's a prong with a second, you know, lever with a space for a pencil in it, and you can draw pictures of boobs, which is what most of the 13-year-olds right. did. Sorry, I don't mean to be grotesque late at night, but anyway, it's that circle drawing mechanism. That's the kind of compass that he's talking about here. So he's comparing the beloved to the fixed foot, right? The foot that has to stay in place. And he's comparing himself to the pen or the pencil in the other foot that has to stretch out and roam. And the beloved calls him back straight. And the final image is of having drawn a perfect circle, right? I can't come back to where I started unless you're there drawing me back and making me stable and straight, pulling everything together into this nice tight circle. So he ends with this sort of image or this comparison out of geometry. And I mean, it's such a beautiful comparison, right? It's so sweet. But remember when I told you that Dunn will take the comparison to the furthest possible limit?
Mm-hmm.
How many degrees in a circle?
Well, that would be 360 as typically reckoned in the Babylonian manner.
How many lines in the poem?
Oh, I did not count.
36.
Done, you bastard. You did it again.
He'll play with these things. I mean, in these fun kinds of ways. I mean, it's you know, I hate to get into ridiculous numerology and stuff like that. But Dunn is one of those writers who will play with things like that from time to time. I don't think it will behoove anybody to go through and count all of his lines. But that's something that he would and could be attuned to. Now, excuse me, the one I want to move to next is the relic. And this is the one where, you know, my old professor really was making a case that this is purposefully and deliciously blasphemous, right? Mm-hmm. And so if you don't mind, I'll go ahead and read this one. This is sort of one of my favorites of Dunn's.
Yeah,
but
of course.
It says, when my grave is broke up again, some second guest to entertain, for graves have learned that womanhead to beat more than one a bed. And he that digs it spies a bracelet of bright hair about the bone. Will you not let us alone and think that there a loving couple lies who thought that this device might be some way to make their souls at the last busy day meet at this grave and make a little stay? If this fall in a time or land where misdevotion doth command, then he that digs us up will bring us to the bishop and the king to make us relics. Then thou shalt be a Mary Magdalene, and I a something else thereby. All women shall adore us, and some men. And since at such time miracles are sought, I would have that age by this paper taught what miracles we harmless lovers wrought. First, we loved well and faithfully, yet knew not what we loved, nor why. Difference of sex no more we knew than our guardian angels do. Coming and going we perchance might kiss, but not between those meals. Our hands ne'er touch the seals, which nature, injured by late law, sets free. These miracles we did. But now, alas, all measure and all language I should pass, should I tell what a miracle she was. All right. So... What theological denomination was England at the time Dunn was writing this?
Well, it was a rather disputed thing, but it was Protestant under the Church of England. And of course, still figuring out what that meant. But
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Decidedly anti-Catholic, though.
There you go. So does the kind of Protestantism that Dunn was sort of living through, did it believe in relics and saints?
It did not. That was one of the first things to go with the, you know, the demolition of the monasteries and the end of the sort of the relic trade and the relic pilgrimage business.
There you go. So this is taking a lot of risks.
Yeah.
This poem is taking a lot of risks. First, he's got this description of when the gravedigger eventually comes to dig up his grave. We're sort of in the territory of Hamlet. You know, if you read Hamlet in the fifth act, Hamlet intervenes at the digging of Ophelia's grave. She's being thrown into a sort of pauper's grave without the rites because it's suggested that she killed herself. But that was pretty common, unless you were high nobility or something like that. You know, we'll dig you a hole and we'll toss you in, and yeah, maybe somebody will put up a stick and, you know, 50, 60, 70 years, we're going to dig another hole in the same plot, might come up with some of your bones.
Yeah.
Sort of what happens in Hamlet.
Yeah.
So when my grave is broke up again, some second guest to entertain, and then he has this weird misogynistic dig, you know, because women hop from bed to bed. Okay. I don't know what to do with that. That's a thing that really mars this poem for me. But he that digs it spies a bracelet of bright hair about the bone. Okay. According to a literal reading of the Revelation, what happens at the end of the world? What do you have to,
you have to remind me. I don't know okay. what you're reaching for.
What does the soul have to do to its body?
Oh, well, it's well, the soul that's a bit disputed.
But never ask somebody who knows his theology this question.
But I believe I think typically like a kind of plain reading of Revelation would be that the body is reconstituted as a heavenly body, that your body is reconstituted physically, but in a perfected spiritual form, that the matter that composes it is a perfected spiritual incorruptible matter.
Yeah. And you got to go back down and get it.
You got to go. Right. Exactly. Like it's a literal raising of the dead. Yeah.
There's a literal raising of the dead. So you got to go back and put your body all back together. And this is why some denominations still don't believe in blood transfusions or organ donation and things like that.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Yeah. That's why I was like, well, it's a little disputed. And I know that there's a wonderful, or to me anyway, I think a very fascinating interpretation of like what happens at death. Which is, I believe this is a term that's mostly used to deride it, but it's the doctrine of soul sleep, which is that the soul itself is the, you might think of it as basically being, well, again, this is also, you know, disputed or whatever, but it's necessarily, and something that like the physical resurrection of the dead sort of indicates is that your soul actually isn't separate from your body.
Yeah.
That when you are going to live forever, with Christ, that it requires your body to do so, which means that your soul must somehow be encoded in your body, so that when you die, it's actually just a succession of awareness, and that the next moment you experience will be waking up in your celestial body to spend eternity with Christ in the New Jerusalem. So that your soul, that awareness just ends. It goes to sleep, so to speak, until such time when the millennium arrives, which I thought is a very compelling kind of interpretation. I think it's very interesting.
That is wild, man.
Yeah.
I hope so.
It would be great to die and then, you know, we'll blink and wake up. Well, I mean, you know, I don't think I'm going to get the eternal life. I'm probably not so lucky. I think, I don't know. We haven't really discussed it here, but I'm a Calvinist, atheist. I'm not convinced that there's any such thing as God, but that's only because God didn't see fit to plant the seed of faith in me.
Yeah, I think my religion revolves around card tricks at this point, but mm-hmm. but that's the idea. So if you have to put your body back together at the end of the world, why would you have somebody else's hair with you?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because they also would have to put their bodies back together, and they'd have to find that piece of hair.
You'd have to, right. They'll have to, you know, you're creating a circumstance where you get a nice, a happy coincidence, a run in. Like, oh, hey, fancy meeting you here at the end of the world.
Will he not let us alone and think that they're a loving couple, lies who thought that this device might be some way to make their souls at the last busy day meet at this grave and make a little stay? Hey, honey, I'll see you on the other side. We got 15 minutes till we ascend. What do you want to do? Yeah. He's taking his theology. He's taking it literally, and he's taking it to the furthest possible point. All right. If this fall in a time or land where misdevotion doth command, if for some reason England has become Catholic again, then he that digs us up will bring us to the bishop and the king to make us relics. They'll become the saints of love. Then thou shalt be a Mary Magdalene, and I a something else thereby. Mm-hmm. Well, if she's Mary Magdalene, then what is he?
Yeah. I mean, that also jumped out at me because, like, that's placing yourself near to Jesus himself, right? I mean, who was the figure most associated with Mary Magdalene? Like, who, like, she was the beloved companion of Christ. I mean, that's, you know.
Yeah. So he seems to be calling himself the sexual Jesus here.
Indeed. Okay. See, I love this. I'm loving it more and more because he's thinking three steps ahead. He's living in 3021. He is going to game the resurrection to his sexual end.
Oh, no. We haven't even gotten to the best part.
Oh, boy.
I would have this poem buried with me to explain mm-hmm. exactly the nature of our love. First, we loved well and faithfully. Did they love each other well and faithfully? No.
Yeah.
They loved their partners well and faithfully, yet knew not what we loved nor why. Difference of sex no more we knew than our guardian angels do. Coming and going, we perchance might kiss, but not between those meals. Our hands ne'er touch the seals which nature, injured by late law, sets free. The late law is marriage. Adam and Eve in the garden didn't have to get married because they were purely natural.
Yeah.
The late law that injures nature is marriage. We were faithful to our spouses, and we never did anything. We were good kids. These miracles we did, but now, alas, all measure and all language I should pass, should I tell what a miracle she was. The miracle is that we never broke our marriage vows. And the true miracle was this wonderful woman who really and truly I'm connected to in my soul, but we just didn't have the chance. Mm-hmm. How do the marriage vows run, Daniel? To love, well, honor, cherish, and obey till
until death do us part.
And now, buddy, do you get it?
Uh-huh. Like, hey, we went through death. The scoreboard set to zero, baby.
He found the loophole.
That's right. Oh, done, you dog.
I told you, just gets better and better, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You're right. He's always thinking three steps ahead. There's this way in which he will take the comparison. He will take the theological comparison to its logical limits and mm-hmm. then find this fascinating, you know, weird loop. Who thinks like this? But he did.
Well, you know? And honestly, I have a kind of, I don't know. I feel a bit simpatico with this kind of thinking, because I mean, well, as we just mentioned, I don't consider myself a believer, but I am deeply interested in the Christian thought tradition and the ways that the faith has been interpreted. And so I do have a kind of, you know, a corpus of knowledge about the various kind of interpretations and disputes that go on in the church. And so I do have a little fun kind of teasing it out in a lawyerly fashion. And so I kind of get it.
Well, you know, what I really – okay, I guess this gets into my own spiritual upbringing. But I guess my experiences of spirituality growing up, I was not, well, I guess I grew up Methodist, but I wasn't exactly, you know, an evangelical Christian, not in that sort of literal tradition, at least not after I was 12 years old. Mm-hmm. You know, you can use the Bible to frighten kids, and that's sort of what was done to me in my Sunday school and things like that. But, you know, as you grow older and as you mature, you sort of have to square things backwards and forwards. And I think there's this tendency, to ignore parts and either not try to fit them in or to take them as super literally and so beyond articulation and so beyond thinking that you just give up on it and say that it is. There's a kind of shutdown.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
What I think I admire about Dunn and Milton as well is that they're taking the parameters of these things seriously and not urging a mental shutdown or a dismissal. Does that make sense?
Mm. Yeah.
They're not saying, well, this doesn't square with how I interpret the world or how I see the world, so I'm just going to ignore it. Or this doesn't square with how I interpret the world, so it must just be like it was back then. And now, you know, I'm going to look for any and every, you know, excuse to justify it in this weird kind of evangelical frenzy. There's a seriousness here and mm-hmm. a seriousness of intellect. Right. This is what we're given. These are the parameters we're given. Let's think through this. And I really sort of admire that. I'm not along for the ride, but I admire the way that he's thinking through it. I admire the intellectual process that someone like Dante is going through.
Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, absolutely.
Even if it is in search of a loophole to finally have sex with, you know, this woman who you found fascinating.
Yeah.
This is serious blasphemy. You have to take it seriously in order to do this. So I guess that gets us to his religious poems. Okay. It's our Valentine's Day episode, and I'm not going to read it, but I would urge everybody to read it on their own. The Elegy to His Mistress Going to Bed.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
sometimes yes. I like to assign this one because we in the 20th and 21st century, God, I'm old. I've crossed us. We tend to believe every generation believes that it invented sex. No, Dunn's right up there. This is straight up erotic poetry.
Yeah.
It's a striptease. That's literally what it is. Piece yep. by piece of his beloved's garments coming off and him admiring each and every part that's underneath. But what happened is he late in life was urged to sort of start writing poetry again. And he wrote holy sonnets. These are love poems written to the divine. Mm-hmm. And he's got some really, really beautiful love poems to God. So if I'm looking in my book, I can't find them. There are a couple that I think we would be remiss if we didn't cover. And mm-hmm. I guess we can jump in and do Death Be Not Proud.
Let's see.
Do you want to take this one?
Oh, you know what? I don't see that anywhere in my little book here. I'll have to
pull it up.
That's okay. I'm on the page. I'll go ahead.
All right, you take it, man.
Death, be not proud, though some have called thee mighty and dreadful, for thou art not so. For those whom thou think'st thou dost overthrow, die not, poor death, nor yet canst thou kill me. From rest and sleep, which but thy pictures be, much pleasure, then from thee much more must flow. And soonest our best men with thee do go, rest of their bones and souls deliver. Thou art slave to fate, chance, kings, and desperate men, and dost with poison, war, and sickness dwell, and poppy or charms can make us sleep as well and better than thy stroke. Why swell'st thou then? One short sleep past, we wake eternally, and death shall be no more. Death, thou shalt die. What a lovely, consoling poem.
Mm-hmm.
To think and about death as this useless entity.
Yeah.
You're not powerful. You have no control.
And I think that's the core of the Christian message. And I think it's a beautiful expression of it. And once again, yeah. You know, I mean, Dunn takes it seriously, even if he's a weird horn dog about it.
But I love this sort of denigration of death. We can't fear you. You're not in control. Thou art slave to fate, chance, kings, and desperate men. You're a tool used by idiots, by anyone and everyone. I love chance, right?
Yeah.
Just happenstance. And popular charm can make us sleep as well. But what a lovely and final statement. Death, thou shalt die. I love it. There's something, I use the word consoling, and that's the word that I would use here. There's something consoling about this, that when you're scared of mortality and you know, we're living through this pandemic, I think, you know, it's sort of like a background buzz in all of our minds, or I suppose it should be. It's hard to avoid, and it's hard to find solace. And a poem like this, though I'm not a believer, it's comforting. It puts things into perspective in a way, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then, well, I guess we can end on one of his creepier poems, or I guess creepy from a certain perspective, Batter My Heart, Three-Personed God. This is Sonnet 14. Batter my heart, three-personed God, for you as yet but knock, breathe, shine, and seek to mend, that I may rise and stand, or throw me, and bend your force to break, blow, burn, and make me new. I, like an usurped talent, another do labor to admit you, but oh, to no end, reason your viceroy in me should defend, but is captived and proves weak or untrue. Yet dearly I love you, and would be loved fain, but am betrothed unto your enemy. Divorce me, untie, or break that knot again. Take me to you, imprison me, for I, except you enthrall me, never shall be free, nor ever chaste, except you ravish me. It's a weird poem where he's envisioning himself as a town overtaken by an enemy, asking God to break down the walls, and he is the betrothed of the enemy, asking God to break that knot and rape him with the spirit. It captures, you know, as creepy as it is, it seems to capture just in its tone this this desire for not transcendence for redemption.
Right. Yeah. And the knowledge that it's going to have to come from some force outside of himself.
Yeah.
And it's almost, it's,
I don't know. And again, I don't know how interested our listeners are in me sort of taking my scalpel and parsing, you know, which tradition of Christianity is drawing on that. But it feels a bit Calvinist.
Yeah, it does.
Like
the
idea, of course, like, you know, the Calvinist idea, of course, the kind of, I mean, it's most famous for predestination, but I think the more salient and at least emotionally salient aspect of the Calvinist kind of conception is one of the kind of pervasive rot at work in human spirits, and that there is no redemption or salvation without God choosing to do so for you, taking that initiative and breaking down the walls that you are born with just by being human. It's really striking.
Yeah, it's weird. And this is what I mean. He can't get that kind of violent violation out of his theology. It's strange. But it also gets at, I think, that real yearning, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Excuse me. There's something kind of plaintive in this. Again, it's not for everyone. And it leaves me disturbed, you know? But I think that's what that poem is trying to do. His holy sonnets are often trying to rethink that relationship with the divine, or to present it in a new and interesting light. Mm-hmm. The thing that I like about so much of his poetry is that it presents the act of love in some kind of new light. Like, I never thought of using that comparison before. I never thought of using that trope to think about desire before. I never thought of framing this mm-hmm. as a kind of theological clerical loophole before. I never thought of, you know, this, that, or the other. There's something about his reframing of the relationship between, or his thinking through that kind of relationship between the human and the divine that's really sort of fascinating. You know, one of my favorite contemporary poets is Carl Phillips, and mm-hmm. he did a really wonderful book. I wish he would do more prose, because he did this fascinating book called Coin of the Realm. It's just a collection of essays, mm-hmm. but he has this essay that looks at the Psalms and thinks through how the Psalms operate. And he's so extraordinarily attuned to the way that the speaker or the singer of the Psalms is so yearning for the love of the divine, the love of the other, and never completely sure that they're going to get it, but still working again and again and again and again and again to try to meet the expectations of God. I met him at a reading once and sort of asked him about that. And he said, yeah, you know, he's not, he claimed he wasn't exactly a believer, but that he found the Psalms for the most part to be a kind of love poem. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if anybody's sort of interested in any of this, please go read Carl Phillips' Coin of the Realm. I mean, read his poetry, because it's just phenomenal. But his essay on the Psalms really hit me.
Yeah,
there's something like that I think is going on in a lot of Dunn's religious work or a lot of his religious poems, that it's something sort of contemplative and fascinating that I think is usually missing from the religious experience today, but or at least the religious experience as it's often articulated in popular culture, I suppose. Mm-hmm. In any case, I guess that wraps up Dunn. Any last thoughts?
I just want to say I mentioned that I found the poems we were going to read in a little volume of collected Dunn. It's a little, you know, sort of pocket sized paperback that we had at the library, and I will be reading the rest of it. apart from our selections, I mean I enjoyed what I read, but in sort of talking about it with you and getting a little more perspective with it, like, there's
there are dimensions here that I'm very interested to explore. And I absolutely get why he'd be one of your favorites. This is I recommend to everybody, read some John Donne. It's very digestible. You know, these are not, you know, particularly, like, the language isn't particularly obscure. The meter is very solid. It's not like he's, you know, going off on a T.S. Eliot spree or something. I don't want to say short, because that makes it sound like that's somehow a problem, or that I cannot read a long poem, although maybe I can't. But they're precise.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing extra. It's a really, they're little gems. So read your John Donne, everybody. This is some special stuff.
All right. So that brings us to the conclusion, and we finished up, I guess, our romance episode. So
our romance slash talk therapy session about Christian theology.
Well, from here we go straight back to the romantic. So we'll get back to lyrical ballads in the coming weeks, and just the real strangeness of that volume. So stay tuned, keep listening, and thanks for putting up with our brief erotic interlude.